Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his new book, Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy, today's guest, Matt Stoller, explores the history of corporate power over the past century and how we became a country shaped by big business. He writes, quote, "Our world looks very different than it did in the mid-70s. There's a sameness to everything. In 1974, we shopped at a local store. Today, we live in a world dominated by chain stores. Take a look around you. You probably have a phone made by one or two companies. You likely bank at one of four giant banks and fly on one of four big airlines. You connect with friends on either Facebook, WhatsApp, or Instagram, all of which are owned by one company. You get your internet through Comcast or AT&T. Data about your thoughts goes into a database owned by Google," end quote. Only three companies control about 80% of mobile telecoms. Three companies own 95% of credit cards. Four companies control 85% of U.S. corn seed sales. And just last year, Facebook and Google made up a combined 60% of the digital ad industry in the United States, totaling roughly $65 billion in revenue. According to Recode by Vox, there is enormous consolidation and fewer choices. So how did we get here, and what will it take to truly take on concentrated power? Matt Stoller is a fellow at the Open Markets Institute. That's an organization that works to address threats to democracy and individual liberties from today's unprecedented levels of corporate concentration and monopoly power. He was previously a senior policy advisor and budget analyst to the Senate Budget Committee. He also worked in the U.S. House of Representatives on financial services policy, including Dodd-Frank, the Federal Reserve, and the foreclosure crisis. And he has written for a number of publications. And Matt Stoller joins us from NPR in Washington, D.C. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You write that during the most recent financial crisis in 2009-2010, you were a congressional staffer working for a member of Congress on the Financial Services Committee. You kept getting calls from a number of constituents in foreclosure and in crisis, and you said that there was nothing that your government or the Democratic Party could do to help. And it caused you to ask yourself a question, which turned into this book. And that is, our leaders responded to a financial collapse caused by a concentration of wealth and power by pushing even more wealth and power into the hands of the same people that caused it. Tell us a little bit about your experience during that time.
Yeah, so I started working for a member of Congress in 2009, and as the banking system was falling apart, and my orientation was, here's a desk, good luck with the financial crisis, right? And I had no idea what was happening was not a technical set of problems within banking, but was actually a political crisis over how we trade. And that is so out of that. And I, what I saw was, you know, I'm a Democrat, but what I saw was the Obama administration and most of the Democrats around me were making systematically bad decisions to encourage a foreclosure wave, to concentrate wealth and power in the hands of Wall Street. But they weren't doing it because they were corrupt or paid off. They were largely well-meaning. They just made bad decisions. And the reason is because they had a false set of stories in their heads about the past. And I wanted to understand why they made those choices. And so I looked back and traced battles, the ideological battles over corporate power over the last century so that I could get into the minds of the people who were largely in charge in 2007 to 2010 as we restructured our economy in the wake of the financial collapse.
Well, since you brought up Obama in your book, and we'll talk more about this later in the show, but you write that by the time he ran for Senate, he had discovered the new Democratic movement. And in his book, The Audacity of Hope, he praised Bill Clinton's third way framework as pragmatic and non-ideological. And he basically said that the New Deal and the Great Society were sort of, it was like hokey old-time religion.
Yeah, there was a speech he gave at something called the Hamilton Project in 2005 or 6, where he, you know, he was like, oh, we've learned. So the story is that in the first half of the 20th century, we had a similar monopoly problem to the one that we have now. Robber barons kind of corrupting our politics, controlling our markets, and we're able to defeat them. And that was essentially the New Deal. And then the second half of the 20th century, we kind of slowly allowed those robber barons to come back. In the 1970s was this series of debates in which the liberals, actually, the Watergate baby generation, or the baby boom generation, kind of allowed, took the shackles off of concentrated capital, because they thought it was, you know, they looked around and they were like, the problem isn't corporate power, the problem is the Pentagon sending us to war in Vietnam and their civil rights and environmentalism. And so they saw an alliance with corporate power and concentrated capital instead of the traditional populist suspicion. Now, by the time, and Reagan consolidated that, and then Bill Clinton doubled down on it, and by the time Obama came into office, there was only sort of the faintest flicker of a remembrance that there had been this other way to do things that was the New Deal kind of attacks on concentrated capital. And so Obama and a lot of the people around him were trained in this philosophy that said, well, you know, the way to fix problems in our economy is to is to concentrate power and then hand over that power to technocrats, experts, scientists, aka economists. And, you know, who knows more about banking than the bankers who control the biggest banks? Those are the people who can fix things. You know, Google, you know, don't do evil, right? They're the ones who want to organize the world's information for us. We should let them. And that was the kind of technocratic philosophy that our policymakers, and broadly that Democrats, and as well as Republicans, but I'm a Democrat, so I was thinking about the Democrats. That's the philosophy that they went into the financial crisis with. It's the philosophy that after the financial crisis, they allowed a massive consolidation through mergers in lots of different sectors, but especially big tech. And that's the philosophy that's being debated right now in 2020. But to understand that, to really understand why Elizabeth Warren, why Bernie Sanders are different than what's come before, you have to understand this 100-year-long battle that has largely been hidden from us, to the point that Barack Obama could say, even though he was very ideological around a framework of neoliberalism, that he was just doing what was non-ideological and pragmatic. That's how captured kind of an entire generation was around what they were doing, including me, by the way. I didn't know any of this until I really started researching it.
Well, let's talk about how you came to learn more about this. You write that after years of research, you came to believe that the answer to the question you asked is ideology. In 2000, you write, I didn't know this older tradition had existed. The first hint it was there was when an economist, Jane DeRista, told me how and why the financial system was blowing up almost in real time. At the time, no one else, not the bankers or the lobbyists or government officials, had any idea what the system they had constructed was doing, but she did. So what did she tell you?
Well, so she was, you know, she was saying, oh, well, the, you know, that derivatives market is going to blow up now. And then it did. And then this other market is going to blow up. And, you know, the lobbyists didn't know, the bankers didn't know, Treasury didn't, like, nobody knew what was happening, but she did. And she was like, well, I worked under the last New Dealer in the 1970s, this guy named Wright Patman, who was the chair of the banking committee from 61 to 75. And she told me about him, and she was like, this guy's amazing, you should learn more. And I didn't think much of it, although I was learning about finance then. And then a few years later, I learned about monopoly power and chain stores, and how in the 1930s, we had a similar problem to the one that we have today with Walmart or Amazon in terms of destroying local retailers. They're a similar dynamic. And this law prevented the growth of chain stores. It was called the Robinson-Patman Act. And not enforcing that law in the 1970s led to the explosion of Walmart and then chain stores in the 80s and then Amazon. And I was like, wait a second, Robinson-Patman, an obscure old pricing law that was really important in the 1930s, that Patman, that's the same guy that was the banking committee chair that Jane told me about. Wait, there's something here. And then I learned that he had been the first Democrat to investigate Nixon under Watergate in 1972 before the election. He had also helped impeach Andrew Mellon, who was the robber baron, third richest man in the country, and the Secretary of the Treasury in 1932 at the depths of the Depression. And he had this remarkable story of 46-year history. And then the final episode of that story was in 1975, the first thing that the Watergate baby generation did. And this is the new generation of Democrats that came into Congress. It was Bill Clinton's generation, basically. He didn't win. That was his first race in 74, and he didn't quite win. But that was the entrance of his generation into politics. One of the first things that they did is they removed Wright Patman from the chair chair of the banking committee, kind of at the behest of the bankers, although they didn't know it. They were being kind of manipulated. And I was like, wow, this is a really important story of a congressman who kind of held together the middle class and the New Deal from the late 1920s until the mid-1970s. And he had been, and as I did more research, I learned he had been trained by Louis Brandeis, and Louis Brandeis had been fighting with J.P. Morgan. And there was a whole tradition of that that ended up in the New Deal with FDR going after bankers. It was like, then all of a sudden, the financial crisis of 2009 became, it became very apparent to me that the strategy of policymakers, including, you know, Obama and Geithner and Summers and those guys, was not to prevent a Great Depression. I mean, they wanted to do that. But more importantly, what they wanted to do was to prevent a New Deal. Right. And if you actually look at Obama's writing and Geithner's writing, or something that Obama said in Geithner's autobiography, they're actually critical of FDR and how he handled the stock market crash. And that's the last time that we had dealt with a financial collapse that was as extreme as the one that we dealt with in 2008 and 9. It was 1929, 1930, 1931, 32. And so they were actually critical of these populists. That was the that was the tradition that they were reacting against.
You know, I had never heard of Wright Patman either. What else did you learn about how he dealt with concentrated power and monopolies?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of fascinating. Well, he had to fight with judges, and so there was the people think of the Great Depression and the New Deal as this kind of time when the government really grew, and that was maybe the time when we created some unions, the government put people to work, and what I discovered is that's a pretty narrow way and almost a cynical way to understand what happened. The New Deal was a gang fight between people who believed in democracy. That was the kind of the populist types like Patman and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and a whole series of others, and robber barons and plutocrats. And it was very clear in the 1930s when they looked across the ocean at Italy, at Germany, at places all over Europe, the Soviet Union, they were like, look, if we don't find a path to contain industrial power within a democratic system, then our robber barons are going to finance a Mussolini type of character here, like they did in Italy. And so they understood that the stakes were very high. And the main villain of that decade was a guy named Andrew Mellon. And Andrew Mellon had been trained by J.P. Morgan. He was a kind of a private equity baron. He had been the head of the Treasury Department from 21 to 32 and was enormously corrupt, did a lot of self-dealing. And at the depths of the Depression, Wright Patman was proposed a bill to accelerate the pension for World War I veterans. And World War I veterans, tens of thousands of them, came to D.C. to protest on behalf of this bill, but basically to say the government needs to do something for us. We fought for this country, now, and we're now all desperately poor. We need you to do something. And they had this giant multiracial protest called the Bonus Army for what was called the Bonus Bill, which was Patman's bill. And then Patman ended up filing impeachment articles against Mellon, which forced Hoover to fire Mellon. And then Hoover ordered the army, led by Douglas MacArthur and Dwight D. Eisenhower and George C. Patton, to tear gas the protesters. And they did. And it was a total disaster for Hoover. And that's the moment at which FDR realized, oh, I'm not going to actually have to campaign. But there was a whole battle within the Democratic Party as well, in kind of what the primary was at that point, about whether they were going to run on the problem of prohibition, so that would be the social issue of its day, or whether they were going to run on economic power. And FDR wanted to run on economic power, and Al Smith and a host of others were being funded by the DuPonts and by the utility magnates and didn't. And so there was a battle there. And then when FDR won, all of a sudden, you know, he organized with Ferdinand Pecora, who was this kind of pugnacious lawyer, to embarrass the bankers through congressional hearings. And then he filed criminal complaints against bankers through, you know, Homer Cummings. And then they filed antitrust suits. And it was just this long, long fight. And in that fight, we erected the administrative state. We had antitrust suits. We really reestablished the rule of law, and that the rule of law applied to the powerful, and we decentralized power. We decentralized private power. And so that's the narrative of the New Deal that I tell in my book. It's a story about who governs, right? And so today you see the echo of that in the battle and the debate between Elizabeth Warren and Mark Zuckerberg. And Elizabeth Warren is saying, you know, we the people govern through our democratic government. And Mark Zuckerberg is saying, no, no, let me govern. I'll take care of all of these problems of free speech and racial justice and whatever. Just I'm going to control and govern the social, this particular part of the economy. And that's what you really found. You know, you even saw things like the analogy to China, right? The Nazis, and this I go over in Goliath, and there's a chapter called Trustbusters Against Hitler, where the Nazis actually had a lot of control over the U.S. industrial power through their cartel relationships with American multinationals. And so, you know, which is very similar to the way that the Chinese exert power over the whole West today. So we've had all of, not all of the debates, but many of the debates that we're having today, the ideological debates, we've had them before. And we actually know how to address these problems. It's just that there was this mass airbrushing of corporate power out of the story of America in the 1970s. And so we feel isolated, we feel atomized, we feel unequipped to address power. And everyone just assumes that American capitalism means rancid inequality and dynamism and innovation but with all of these kind of terrible social consequences. And that's actually a really not what it's been at all historically. That's just kind of an invented fantasy of what American capitalism meant post 1978, 1979.
And Matt, before we talk about, let's say, the Reagan era and then Clinton and Obama, when we talk about the New Deal, we have a lot of guests on the show who talk about the New Deal, but what they usually focus on our social programs, for example, all of the amazing art and the murals that came out of the New Deal. We don't hear much about how the New Deal dealt with the issues that you're discussing today. So can you remind us of that, just because it doesn't get as much attention as it deserves?
Right. So, you know, I love, so Wright Patman had this great line where there were dark money funded groups in the 1930s. They're very similar today, anonymously funded groups that were attacking New Dealers and attacking Patman. So there was this group of World War One protesters. They were funded by bankers to say, oh, we don't want what Roosevelt's delivering. And Wright Patman's line was, they only believe in law and order if they write the law and give the order. Right. And that was, you know, LaGuardia, who was in Congress at the same time as Patman, they both did investigations, and then Patman filed articles of impeachment against Mellon, and then they filed a criminal complaint against Thomas Lamont, who was a J.P. Morgan partner, and then Robert Jackson, who later became a Supreme Court justice during the Brown v. Board decision and was a prosecutor at Nuremberg. He made his first big break in 1934 when he led a tax fraud suit against Andrew Mellon. So even after Andrew Mellon had left, then they put him on trial for tax fraud, because you see the same debates today about tax. You saw the same debates then as you see today about tax evasion. And over the course of several years, you know, Jackson put him on trial and exposed how he ran his empire. And then there were the Congress, you know, raised taxes on the wealthy, and they broke up banks, which included the Mellon banks. They broke up the aerospace industry, which, Mellon had some control over airlines. They broke up the electric utility industry, and Mellon had a lot of interests in electric utilities all over the country. And then they created in certain areas, they created unions. So, you know, traditionally, American political economy, anti-monopolism, has been about decentralizing power, making sure that the family farmer can succeed, making sure the independent shopkeeper can succeed. But in industries where you have some economies of scale, like, say, aluminum or steel, then you can't necessarily have a family-run steel company, but you can shield the workers from concentrations of power with unions. There were changes to a whole series of there were changes to bankruptcy law. There were changes to criminal law. I mean, there was the New Dealers used the law itself to bring democracy and to restore democracy, and that's what the New Deal was. And then on top of that, you know, we built, or at least, you know, people built the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s using some of the economic tools that the New Dealers had developed. And that contest over power, between the bankers who thought we're going to run the country, we are the legitimate actors in our society, and these giant financial holding companies, these technologically advanced, you know, the Rockefellers and the Morgans and the DuPonts and the Mellons, that really structured our economy and our politics, what FDR called an informal economic government of the United States, they lost power, right? That's what happened, is we took power from them and found sort of an imperfect but a real democracy. And that's what the New Deal was actually about. And so when people talk about art, they talk about social, you know, social welfare programs, all of that is true, but it leaves out the what really happened, which was a battle over power. Mm-hmm.
Today, we're speaking with Matt Stoller about his new book, Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. Matt is a fellow at the Open Markets Institute. This is an organization that works to address threats to democracy and individual liberties from today's unprecedented levels of corporate concentration and monopoly power. So, Matt, again, before we get into Reagan, we'll probably do that after a break because we have about 3 minutes. So what you just laid out there about the New Deal and how things drastically changed, what happened at that point? I mean, how did the corporatists come back into power to kind of, again, change it back to the way it was?
Well, so they seized control of history. So in the late 1940s and early 1950s, there was a historian named Richard Hofstadter who invented a new way of understanding America. So the New Dealers believed that there were a series of farmers in the 1880s and 1890s who were battling railroads and banks and robber barons it was a war between democracy and monopoly power. And Richard Hofstadter and a whole bunch of Columbia people at Columbia University, and then some people in the New Left, the C. Wright Mills, and then this great economist, John Kenneth Galbraith, created a new history. And they said, in fact, none of that's true. There wasn't really a battle over the money trust. All that stuff is kind of a fantasy. In fact, what happened is these farmers were really just nervous about the fact that they were Anglo-Saxons, and they were losing their kind of cultural privilege in a moment when you had a lot of immigrants, what was called status anxiety. And the money trust was a sort of a paranoid conspiracy. These were racist and anti-Semitic cranks. And Hofstadter was very clear. He said Herbert Hoover and FDR had the same ideology. Americans never disagreed about ideology. And this was during the McCarthy period. So they were trying to kind of create a new way of understanding America and framing hostility to concentrated capital as just proto-fascism, like the same way that McCarthy was drawing upon small business people. That's just what the farmers of the 1880s were doing. And that history really influenced the baby boomers. So it was hard in the 60s to find a book to find a college student without a Galbraith book on their shelves. And so in the 1970s, when this kind of generation started coming of age, they had this entirely different image in their head about what America was about. And they were like, oh, there's no such thing as political economy. There's no such thing as corporate power. That's something that the scientists, the economists handle. We battle over problems like Vietnam and flag burning and sort of social questions. And it left them totally unequipped to address the problem of the problems of the New Deal that happened in the 70s, which were inflation and kind of corrupt, the beginnings of financialization.
And then, as you write, when Reagan came to power in 1982, he went on PBS and said that the Roosevelt administration had been full of fascists and communists and continually attacked the New Deal coalition. And we'll talk about that after a break. Today, we are speaking with Matt Stoller about his new book, Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. In the book, Matt Stoller explains the history of corporate power over the past century, and he also looks at how we became a country shaped by big business and what it will take to truly take on concentrated power. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Please welcome Jim Anderson from our development team and producer Leah Cesarine. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi there.
Good morning, Leah. Now, I know that you shared with us yesterday that you've been working with Your Call, working with Rose, for a little while now. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about, you know, what are some of the things that you've enjoyed most as you've been working with the show? But before you share that with me, I'd like to remind our listeners that we are in the beginning of our fall pledge drive. And this is a very special pledge drive because we're running a bold experiment. We're trying to do, we already do the shortest membership campaigns and fundraising campaigns on air in the Bay Area, and we already run the shortest number of minutes per hour in order to encourage your support. But many of you have said, hey, can you do it even shorter? So we're trying to do this just 8 days to raise the same amount of money, and that means we have to hit hourly goals every hour. The goal for Your Call today is $1,500, and the good news is that already we have raised $500, so less than $1,000 to go for the show today. We know that this is appointment listening for many of you. Here's your opportunity to support it. You can call us at 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917, or make that contribution securely online at kalw.org. And so, Leah, just a couple of things that you really like about the show?
Yeah, if you appreciate shows, learning about history from the history of water in California to the history of the U.S. economy. I mean, we cover shows that are truly special, and if you enjoy listening, you should call now and support us.
You should, and if you can make a contribution of just $120, either in a one-time sum or by making $10 per month contributions, we'd love to send you Goliath, the book by Matt Stoller that we're listening to today. So please visit us at kalw.org or make that call at 800-525-9917. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by Matt Stoller, author of Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy. And if you have any questions for Matt about what he found in his book, what your thoughts are about monopolies, we deal with them on a probably hourly basis in our lives every single day. In fact, we just don't have that many choices anymore when it comes to doing basic things like using a phone, making sure that we have electricity, buying concert tickets. That's another one that's really big. So what are your thoughts on this? Give us a call at 866-798-8255. We will also talk about plans to break up tech and what that would actually look like. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Matt, I want to talk about Reagan, Clinton, and Obama, and we have about 30 minutes left, but I think I'll bring up tech first, just in case we run out of time. Yesterday, Mark Zuckerberg, as you know, was grilled on Capitol Hill. The last time around, he didn't get very many good questions, but this time around he did. And there's a number of calls to break up companies like Facebook and Google. And I just wonder what your thoughts are. Roger McNamee is a Silicon Valley investor who was an early supporter of Facebook. Now he's very critical of the company. And he was on Democracy Now! Yesterday. And he said, if Facebook allows the same misleading ads and lies in 2020 that they allowed in 2016, and based on what Zuckerberg said, that's going to happen, he believes the company should be shut down. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that the basic problem with both Google and Facebook is that they have corrupt business models. So in 1998, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, before they became billionaires, these are the co-founders of Google, they wrote a paper and they talked about search engines and the problem with search engines that were financed by advertising. They said advertising, when you have a search engine and you make money with advertising, you have an incentive to self-deal, right? And you have an incentive to keep your users on your page and not give them the best result, but give them the result that serves you or that serves your advertiser. And that's a huge problem, and it's one that can't be avoided. And that's true for information utilities in general, like social media and search and mapping and so on. I mean, they were right, right? And yet then they turned to advertising and became the billionaires that they are. And you see that the world is increasingly based on these platforms who engage in addiction. They try to engage in addictive behavior so that they surveil you, so that they can sell advertising. So if you want to address the problem, it's very simple. You just break these companies up because they're too big to be managed effectively, but then bar them from being in the advertising business, right? You should, if you want a social media company, you should pay directly with money. We've been, when you pay with your attention, you pay by foregoing your democracy. You don't exactly know what you're paying with, and it's a deceptive business model. So, Facebook sells manipulation services, and we have to make this the case as a society that we don't think that you should be able to be a communication network that sells manipulation services. I don't think Facebook needs to be shut down. I just think that they should not be allowed to be in the advertising business anymore.
So how would we go about this? How would you see this playing out? If you're going to break up companies like Facebook and Google, what does it look like?
Well, you can do it in a number of different ways. This is not what I call an or problem. It's not that you do antitrust or regulation. You do this is an and problem, right? So in the New Deal, the way that we took on the Mellon system is we broke up a bunch of different parts of it. There were also antitrust suits. There was a bunch of regulatory action. There was unionization. There were tax suits, right? So we have to the basic problem. So what I saw yesterday when Zuckerberg was testifying was I saw the Zuckerberg is not really just a business leader. He is the de facto global privacy regulator, right? Mm-hmm. He governs. And I saw a bunch of frustrated members of Congress who were like, this guy can't be fired. This guy can't be held accountable. We can't make him do anything. He is governing our privacy. He is governing in some ways our elections. And yet there's no accountability here. There's no democracy here. To solve that, you need to govern again, right? We haven't really had the government do anything to structure markets for 40 years. So we have to start doing that again in lots of different areas. And so, yeah, an antitrust suit or a regulatory choice or a statute that would break up and, Facebook would be a start. But we have to, start wielding power through public institutions again, because if we don't do it through democratic mechanisms, well, then, other people or governments like the Chinese will do it for us, and that will not be democratic.
It is pretty shocking that a company like Facebook, and Mark Zuckerberg basically says, he said this yesterday, quote, when asked about putting up political ads with clear false information, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez basically said, what if I put up an ad against Republicans running in primaries saying that they voted for the Green New Deal? It clearly never happened. And then he says, quote, in most cases in a democracy, I believe people should be able to see for themselves what politicians that they may or not vote for are saying and judge their character for themselves. I mean, what do you think of this?
I'm annoyed we have to care what this plain omelet of a mediocrity man, thinks. Like, Mark Zuckerberg is not it's just crazy that we have to care what he thinks. Mm-hmm. He's not very good at thinking or conceptualizing. He's a good businessman and he's a good engineer, but he is terrible at governing. And his thoughts and ideas about politics are silly. They're incoherent. They're nonsense, right? He shouldn't be in a position where he is making these kinds of claims, and we have to care what he thinks. We should be making these decisions through our democratic institutions. That's what I think about this.
How much power do you think they will have in 2020? Because Brittany Kaiser, who worked at Cambridge Analytica, said that if Trump wins in 2020, blame Facebook. What are your thoughts on people who believe that?
Well, look, I mean, the reason that Trump won is because Obama did a really bad job as president. And I don't think there's – I mean, I think you can make an argument that, there are a million things that caused Trump to win, right? So, Clinton didn't go to Michigan enough, but, that could be one – he should instead do the correct spending. But the reality is this is a miserable country, and our lifespans are going down. There is a huge opioid epidemic. People are upset, mm-hmm. and they're upset for legitimate reasons. So I find it annoying and dishonest for people. And I saw the foreclosure crisis. It was a disaster. The way we handled it was just deeply immoral. So if people are mad, I'm not going to say that, they were manipulated into being unhappy. No, this is an unhappy country. And, Clinton did it. George Bush did it. Obama did it. And now Trump is doing it. Like, people have grounds for complaint. Yeah. The Facebook is making things a lot worse. Facebook is stealing our ability to think. So that is a huge problem. If Trump wins re-election, I think we can, I'm not exactly sure kind of who to blame, but what I would say is that, my view is that if you want to run, and I see changes in political thinking on both sides of the aisle. The Republicans are getting much more suspicious of concentrated power. So is business. So are the Democrats. So if the Democrats are not able to put up a coherent candidate that wants to take on the autocrats that surround us in the commercial sector, then that's why we're going to, you know, that's why the Democrats are not competitive, because who won't be competitive? It's like why should people trust us?
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the big question. And we haven't answered that yet.
Well, and adding to your comment about Facebook affecting our ability to think, as you point out in your book, and this is another crisis, since 2004, roughly 1,800 local newspapers in the United States have disappeared. Over 2,000 of the 3,143 counties in the U.S. now have no daily newspaper.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a concentration of power that is extraordinarily dangerous and has a lot of important impacts. I think the biggest impact is on the local communities, because it allows for more corruption and problems, because journalists are the watchers over our society, and they're the ones who identify problems. And so we've kind of are starting to get rid of all of the watchers over our society. And people can still see enough about national politics to make judgments there, but not local politics anymore, and local businesses and local institutions. So that's a huge problem.
Today we're joined by Matt Stoller, a former congressional staffer working for a member of Congress on the Financial Services Committee during the financial crisis. And he's out with a new book, Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Greg in Redwood City. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. I just want to ask what your guest thinks about co-ops. Like, you know, we have these incredibly smart kids working in these tech firms, and all this money is being funneled into us, you know, small group of hands. And I'm wondering if, you know, if you look at like co-op models where the employees are, you know, have equity, and everybody's kind of working for the benefit of both the public and the employees.
It's a great question and an important question, because, you know, there have been two ways that traditionally that in America that we've secured liberty. The first is by protecting ourselves from concentrated capital, and that's antitrust and regulatory tools in the administrative state. And then the other is by allowing everyone who produces, right, workers and farmers and so on and so forth, engineers, to band together in different ways. And that's farm supports and unions, but also co-ops are an important part of that. And, you know, it depends how the co-op is structured, but co-ops can be incredibly useful. There are co-ops all over the country. There are a lot. We did a rural electrification that way in the 1930s, and a lot of those kind of still exist. So it can be really useful. But if you don't shield the co-op from concentrated capital, right, if you have a co-op that's selling a good or a service and is doing a good job, but you allow chain stores funded by concentrated capital to underprice them and lose money, it doesn't matter what kind of structure you have, because they're just going to get killed, right? So you need, like, WeWork with unlimited amounts of capital is going to be able to kill any kind of co-op working space that exists, because they can just underprice them because they're at subsidized rates. So you have to do both, but I think co-ops are an important mechanism to allow people to producers, people who make and sell things and engineer things for a living, allow them in certain contexts to be free.
Well, thank you for the call, Greg. I want to spend a little bit of time, like I said earlier, on the Reagan, Obama, and Clinton sections. And I just wonder what really stood out for you when you did your research on Reagan. You write that in 1986, so this is before NAFTA, the administration's Commerce Department invited 38,000 American companies to a trade fair in Acapulco, encouraging them to explore moving their factories to Mexico. Businesses were getting bigger, hollower, and more concentrated, and corporations were consolidating power over individual markets. You also write about some major oil mergers that happened under Reagan. Standard Oil of Ohio bought Kennecott Copper for $1.77 billion. Standard Oil of California bought AMAX. DuPont bought Conoco. What else struck you when you were doing research on Reagan?
Yeah, so it's a totally fascinating area. So what struck me is that the Democrats were super confused in the 1970s because there were all these problems that they didn't know how to address because they were elected to deal with Watergate and Nixon. And then all of a sudden, Nixon and Watergate or Vietnam and Nixon. And those weren't problems by the time they got into office. And then basically in like the 1980s, they were just all on the payroll of the junk bond king, Michael Milken. Right. Not all of them, but a lot of them were. It was just like there was this kind of switch that flipped when they went from confused to just kind of taken money from concentrated capital. And it was, you know, this was the Atari Democrats, the New Democrats, the kind of Gary Hart types, and that really the progenitors to Bill Clinton. And so that's why there wasn't resistance to what Reagan was doing. I mean, there was some resistance about government spending. There was some resistance about his attacks on unions. But Democrats largely went along with how Reagan got rid of antitrust enforcement. And then when Clinton got into, you know, he won, it was a very weird election where Ross Perot was an important third-party factor. And Bill Clinton had this opportunity to either roll back what Reagan had done and return the Democratic Party to its populist roots, standing against concentrated capital. But instead, he did the opposite. He doubled down and made Democrats, and the attempt was to make Democrats the party of Wall Street, compete with the Republicans for the backing of the powerful, which is what Al Smith wanted to do in 1932, but FDR beat him. And Bill Clinton actually pulled it off. And so the merger boom accelerated into the 90s and actually went global. And so the things that you saw Reagan doing with what you were talking about, the maquiladoras factories in Mexico, mm-hmm. you know, Clinton actually established NAFTA and established the WTO and really supersized everything. And so it was under Clinton that, you know, Walmart opened a store in every state. So Walmart exploded in the 70s under Democrats. As they changed pricing laws. And then it further, by 1985, under Reagan, Sam Walton was the richest man in the country. And then in the 1990s, you know, Walmart just exploded both domestically and started to go international. And so it was like that's the kind of moment when the guardrails of our society came off. Because even in the 80s, when Reagan was trying to push this neoliberalism aggressively, people thought, well, the Democrats are there. The Democrats may come back one day. And so we don't want to do too much. And then once it became clear that there was nobody there in charge anymore who cared about applying the rule of law to the powerful or stopping concentrated finance, and that, in fact, there was this ideology which said that concentrated finance was good and was just and brought a just society, it all came off and we stopped prosecuting, and it was, you know, and that was what led to the crisis of 2008.
You also write about the Telecom Act of 96, which we've covered many times on the show. That began the process of reconsolidating the old AT&T as the baby Bells merged. It was horrific for media because there was so much media consolidation. This is one thing, though. We talk a lot about the concentration of food and food companies, but we don't really bring Clinton into this conversation. And now I realize we really should, because you write that Clinton sped up the corporate takeover of rural America by allowing a merger wave in farm country.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was that you saw ConAgra and Monsanto, right. And kind of the big Cargill, like they really started to expand into the food system. They had always been kind of important, but they became just totally dominant. And I go over this. It was really weird to find, because I'm a Democrat. I always thought, oh, Democrats are the good guys, Republicans are the bad guys. But it's like I find this hearing in the 1990s when Senator Conrad Burns, you know, who I remember working against, he was a Montana senator, Republican. He's doing this field hearing in Montana where the Montana farmers are really upset at the ag monopolies. And Joel Klein, who is Clinton's antitrust chief, didn't even bother to show up. Right. And it was just this catastrophe in kind of what I thought of as kind of red state America. And I didn't understand, like, people are like, oh, you know, people and Republicans vote against their own self-interest. And it was like, actually, a lot of things happened in America that I just, you know, I wasn't aware of. And it was because we just didn't see corporate power anymore. And it wasn't just the political leaders who did these kinds of things that didn't see corporate power. You know, most of us were never really even trained or given the traditional American framework around political economy, which is about controlling concentrations of power. We just didn't see it. And so if you weren't there, if you weren't on the farm, you know, if you weren't in the factory, You were told that none of that happened, that none of that existed, but it did. And that's why people were so angry at both the Democrats kind of and the Republicans. Hmm.
The other thing, Matt, that was new to me, you know, I've wondered because the weapons industry is now so consolidated, and I didn't realize that that also goes back to the Clinton administration. You write that during the New Deal, Clifford Dorr fought to decentralize corporate power in the weapons industry to ramp up against the Nazi threat in the late 30s. And then in 1993, Clinton's Deputy Secretary of Defense, William Perry, gathered CEOs of top weapons contractors and told them that they would have to merge into larger entities because of reduced Cold War spending. He said, consolidate or evaporate. Well, they did. As you write, along with cutting 2 million jobs, the number of U.S.-based prime contractors went from 16 to 6. So can you tell us more about that and what that means?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So there were kind of the Cold War era industrial complex, right? Eisenhower talked about it, and he didn't actually say what the left thinks he said. He didn't say the military industrial complex is bad. He said that it's a lot of power, and that power can be used for good and bad, so we have to pay attention to it. And in fact, if you look at sort of new histories of Silicon Valley that are coming out, Silicon Valley is really a result. The wonderful technologies that we have are largely a result of a lot of that spending on the scientific, educational and military complex, but it was done through decentralized means. So it was open markets and a strong antitrust frame from the 1940s. You know, Clifford Dorr was a part of that, establishing it in the late 1930s, all the way into the 1970s. You even saw some echoes of it in the 1990s. But what Clinton did is he basically cut a deal. So Reagan raised defense spending, but the Democrats were in charge, and they kind of had this deal where they said, all right, you can raise defense spending, but we get to write the contracting rules. So it's not going to be that corrupt. I mean, it's always a little bit of corruption, but not that corrupt. You just get to make a lot more money because there's a lot more spending. So they made too many weapons, but the weapons basically worked, right, which you saw in the first Gulf War. And then what Clinton did is he effectively, they went to the defense contractors, and they said, we got to cut spending. What can we do to make you happy? And the defense contractor said, well, you can cut spending or you can hold spending steady, but just raise our margins. And so they got rid of a lot of contracting rules that allowed the government to keep sole source contracts under control, which is monopoly contracts. They allowed this massive merger wave. That's when Lockheed became Lockheed Martin. It's when Boeing bought McDonnell Douglas, which is there's a straight line from Boeing, which used to make great airplanes, to Boeing, which now makes the 737 MAX. You can thank Bill Clinton for that. You saw this this roll-up in this vital part of the American political economy, which is the aerospace and defense and electronics sector. And that was Pentagon policy. That was Bill Clinton's policy. That was William Perry's policy choice. And actually, Bernie Sanders, when he was in the House, was one of the few people that was actually fighting against that. He had his bill called No Payoffs for Layoffs. But, you know, you do see, like, across our economy, even though kind of underpinning the Clinton administration was this financial bubble, so people thought things were going well because their income was going up, or a lot of people thought that way. Underlying it all was this incredible concentration of power and incredible corporate consolidation, and which was sort of part of there was a lot of offshoring involved in that. But it really laid the foundations for the crisis of capitalism that we're in today.
And Matt, we only have about a minute left. Mark in Oakland, I don't have time to take your call, but he says, what do you think about Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders' solutions to take on corporate power?
I think they're good. I think we're getting there. I think restoring the rule of law matters, and we need to decentralize. We need to put a little bit of property in everyone's hands. That's the anti-monopoly model, not consolidate property and then let people have a vote over centralized property. It needs to be decentralized, and that's the basis of anti-monopolism and liberty. So in Goliath, I trace this history because this history has really been hidden from us, and it's been hidden for us for a reason, so that we would be unequipped to demand liberty. But every generation gets a chance at it. And this is our generation's chance. So, you know, that's the battle ahead of us. It's going to be a weird and fun and scary ride.
Well, Matt, we'd love to have you back to talk more about the battle and about more solutions. But thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Thanks a lot.
Matt Stoller was a congressional staffer working for a member of Congress on the Financial Services Committee. And his new book is called Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.